I sent you an email.
House Committee on Revenue for February 16, 2017 will come to order. The first item of business is our information meeting on the Fish and Wildlife Revenue Task Force. You want to give us an introduction, and then we'll hear from those who want to testify. We've got quite a group here today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the task force for the funding of Fish and Wildlife has been meeting during the interim, and this was kind of to try to come up with some different funding ideas for funding mechanisms that may sustain the Department of Fish and Wildlife into the future. The primary two options that came from the task force for funding included a income tax return surcharge of 0.62% of the tax that's already owed, and that would be to generate $86.9 million in a full biennium. This would have a low-income exemption, those that make less than $20,000 or receive the earned income tax credit would be exempt from that type of income tax return surcharge. And there are a number of sorts of estimates of how that would affect various people in tax situations, from a single person with no dependents to a family of four. The impact on tax can range from $0 for a family of four with $25,000 a year in income, all the way to about $78.36 for a single person with no dependents who made $150,000 a year. The second revenue option that the task force had developed was a surcharge on beverage containers, and the amount of the surcharge would be 2.19% of the wholesale amount, and this would also be able to generate the $86.9 million target in a full biennium.
Okay, thank you. Has this task force report been made to other committees? Do you know? We'll ask them. Well, I'm not sure how you want to do this, but task force members and members of the legislature, you pick your panels, and we'll start from there. And I would say the first thing to do with the committee is not to talk about revenue options, as we just heard, but rather talk about the problem and what you need in terms of outcomes. The specifics of revenue issues, I think, are something that are peculiar within the purview of the committee, but we don't know anything, officially at least, about the issues that Fish and Wildlife is dealing with. Representative Helm, thank you much for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken Helm, State Representative for House District 34. I was one of four legislators that served on the committee, and I'm lucky I didn't drink the water or the coffee or something, because the other three are gone. That would be, they're still alive, but so Senator Whitsitt, Senator Edwards served as well, and then my friend Representative Krieger as well, and so I'm the last legislator standing, and that's not why I'm here, not that I'm the last one left, but I think I'm here because I care a lot about the work that we accomplished. The both chambers sent this task force off to do its work under House Bill 2402 to try to figure out how to bridge a long-term budget gap for the department that has developed over time and is the result essentially of declining license, both fishing and hunting license sales. The task force that was formed was an extraordinary group of people that represent a broad spectrum of both industry, conservation, hunting, and fishing interests, as well as folks representing urban interests that have to do with how we get people back into the parts of the state that offer these opportunities for outdoor recreation of all sorts. Mr. Chair, I think you're exactly right about how we go about looking at this presentation today. Please don't get too far down the path of considering the revenue options that we suggest. The key point here is that the task force gathered information from other states and other sources in an effort to understand how to transform the department into one that both serves hunters and fishermen and folks that just like to be outdoors and recreate and enjoy the non-consumptive uses of the landscape. And the conclusion that we came to after a lot of excellent discussion and review of that information is that we need to be able to fund the long-term vision of the Department for Wildlife Conservation. And the department has a wildlife conservation strategy. We tried to figure out, with the department's help, how much that would cost and fit the revenue ask, so to speak, to meet that need. And that's what you're going to hear about today. In particular, this leverages some knowledge that we got from other states that have been able to pull this off. And I think you'll hear Missouri is a place, surprising to me, that got it right a number of years ago, raised the money that they need for adequate fish and wildlife management, and have been benefiting by that ever since. So this is not just a how do we patch the hole in the budget bucket exercise. It's a vision for how we adequately fund the department over time, well beyond the three biennia that we were tasked with looking at in the bill. And with that, I'm going to exit for my Ways and Means Subcommittee and leave it to the folks that really know what they're talking about.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for being here and for that very good introduction.
So, Chair Barnhart, my name is Mark Labhart. And I just recently had the privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner, just retired as a Tillamook County Commissioner, where I spent 12 years there, and then I spent 34 years in state government, most of that managing the Tillamook State Forest. Mm-hmm. I'm now a Eastern Oregon representative. I'm living in Sisters right now, going back and forth. I actually grew up in Heppner. I was born in Heppner, so I know.
Bless you.
There's not many people that can even say that. So I'm going to kick it off for the presentation. I was had the privilege of being the chair appointed to bring this committee's work to your attention today. I'd like to, before I actually begin, ask the members in the audience, members from the task force, if they could please stand and be recognized, and also representatives from organizations that helped with the legislation. They drove down today from various parts of the state to be here today. So if we could please stand, and then there's the organizations that helped craft 2402. There's at least a couple that are here
today.
A couple
more. So, you want to introduce them?
Go ahead. Kenji, go ahead.
Well, you either do it from the mic, or we'll do it later.
Okay.
When they testify.
So, Kenji? Well, I don't think they're going to testify.
I think this is
just going to be an informational hearing with just the two
just
of us.
Just the two of you. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming. We very much appreciate it. And welcome to your legislature. Please.
Okay. And then also...
Kenji, go ahead.
Director Melcher is also in the room, and he's available to answer questions. But the reason he's not at the table is we want to make it clear that we are a legislative committee. We're not a department committee. We were this was a bill from the legislature, and so we are a legislative committee reporting back to you. So Representative Helm did cover some things I'm going to go very quickly through. We were established by the 2015 session. Again, governor appointed 17 members, and it was a diverse group of individuals from all corners of Oregon. You can see on the PowerPoint there, and six ex officio members, and I think the representative did a good job of covering those. Here's the actual members. You know, you can see some players in there. You don't usually see Columbia Sportswear, Leupold and Stevens, Multnomah County Health Department. So we had a very diverse group of individuals that helped to put this together. Our charge was threefold. First was to identify and recommend potential alternative sustainable funding sources for ODF&W. That's where we spent the majority of our time. We started in January, and we met almost monthly for the entire year here at the Capitol and the downstairs hearing room. We are also charged to recommend any adjustments necessary to ensure that relevant program areas are funded in accordance with the intent that you gave us in House Bill 2402, or the legislature gave us. And finally, to recommend opportunities to better achieve the mission through leveraging, coordinating, and budgeting funds from alternate and existing sources. So the challenge that we had, there was a Secretary of State's audit that indicated that ODFNW had some pretty severe cash flow problems, and that threatened the financial health of the agency. The agency took some dramatic steps, reducing staffing significantly and reducing their budget significantly. But they still had some pretty major issues, and please interrupt me if you have any questions or comments as I go along. So this is some of the headlines that were out there. Fee hikes for hunting and fishing licenses. As you may or may not be aware, there are three scheduled fee increases for ODFNW hunting and fishing license. One has already been in effect. There are two more scheduled. With the revenue sources that we're recommending, we are going to recommend that those fee increases do not go in place. And of course, there's some blowback when you raise hunting and fishing licenses and put a lot of the ODFNW mission on the backs of hunters and fishers for conservation type activities. And we'll go into that in a little more detail as we go along. The challenge that we have is conservation aspects of ODFNW's mission have not historically been adequately funded. It's the mission of hunting and fishing license fees pays for the agency. And the legislature passes laws, rules, regulations that require other types of uses, conservation types of uses out there. Comprehensive sustainable fish and wildlife management funding is critical to Oregon's livability. It's critical to Oregon's economy, both now and into the future. And you're going to see in this presentation, we don't want you to try to solve the problem in the short run. We'd like to have you consider solving this problem for the long term, not just fix it in one biennium. We need to couple the expanded conservation efforts with enhanced hunting and fishing opportunities with a goal to minimize the need for future fee increases and the attendant political battles that you face when you try to raise hunting and fishing license fees. A need to improve the educational outreach and engagement of the public in supporting healthy fish and wildlife habitats, need to engage diverse and underserved communities, and the difficult funding decisions needed now only more difficult in the future, so our approach is more proactive to avoid problems such as ESA listings. So the process, I'm going to turn it over to Jim, and he'll introduce himself.
Yep. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Owens. I had the privilege of facilitating the task force and with working with Mark and the other members who are here. And so we provided you a copy of the full report. You were to wave this around.
I was.
At your leisure, we recommend you look through this. And we also want to thank Christine and her staff for all the support they gave us through the process. And I'm going to touch on a couple things very quickly so that there's time for your questions today. In terms of process, Representative Helm and Chair Laphart covered most of that. But I wanted to point out that one of the things we did early on was a survey of a statistically valid survey of 900 Oregonians to assess the attitudes about what the mission of ODFNW should be and how well it's doing its job, and also to assess people's understanding of how the department is funded currently. And we heard a resounding support for conservation of fish and wildlife and habitat and opportunities for outdoor recreation as the priority for the department. We also heard that people think the department's doing a pretty good job in that regard. The disconnect was that people had very little understanding of how the department is funded and how are we funding fish and wildlife conservation in the state. Most folks thought we were funding it through the general fund. And as you know, less than 10% of the department's budget is from the general fund. We next, after we did research on other states, as Representative Helm indicated, and we did this survey of Oregonians, we used all that to help us identify what we would want to accomplish with alternative funding. And Christine mentioned that we identified a funding target of close to $87 million. Well, we didn't just grab that figure out of the air. We spent many, many hours defining what the mission of the department would be if you carried it out fully. And we then broke that down into four funding needs. One was to expand the current conservation efforts in the department. What would it take to fully implement the Oregon Conservation Strategy and the Nearshore Strategy and other aspects of the department's mission? And we identified a funding need of close to $47 million per biennium for that. The legislation also told us to look at how to improve hunting and fishing opportunities, so we did that, and we, as part of that, Representative Helm mentioned that we looked at opportunities to reduce or eliminate future fee increases. We identified a funding target for that of a little over $22 million per biennium. Legislation also directed us to look at how to better connect Oregonians with the outdoors. That program would be about $8.3 million per biennium. And lastly, we took a look at the deferred maintenance challenge the department faces, and that was a high point of the Secretary of State's audit. And we've recommended a package of close to $10 million per biennium for a number of bienniums to address that. So all of this resulted in the $87 million per biennium revenue target that Christine articulated earlier. That's about a 23% increase in the department's current budget. It's a 15% increase in FTEs, and of course, all this is scalable. And I'm really not going to...
Let me break in there. When you say it's scalable, could you say a little bit more about what you mean by that?
So that would be full implementation of the...
Okay, that answers my question.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, again,
Representative Bueller, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Could you share with me what that mission is? You said you carefully went through. Is that listed somewhere on your slides?
It's not in our slides. It is in our report. And it's a multifaceted mission. I could find it quickly. Can I come back to that? Because I don't want to misarticulate it.
And that mission was generated from statute or from...
Yes.
Where was it?
Statute. And we do have department representatives here who can probably articulate it for word for word. So we had the four initiatives. One was expanding the conservation efforts, and I'm not going to go through the details of that, but it was about a little over half of the recommended funding. Improving hunting and fishing was a little over 25% of the funding. Connecting Oregonians with the outdoors was about 10% of the funding. And addressing the deferred maintenance over time was also a little over 10% of the funding. Mark?
And that's like hatcheries, buildings, those kinds of things. In a lot of cases throughout the state, a lot of buildings are in pretty bad shape, and so that's what we're referring to and refer to deferred maintenance there. So let's talk about the foundation for the task force recommendations and establish this Oregon Conservation and Recreation Fund. It's dedicated to the conservation, management, research, habitat improvements, administration, enforcement, and other activities that protect and maintain enhanced native fish and wildlife. Provides resources to improve hunting and fishing, expand opportunities for participation in outdoor recreation. And this outdoor recreation isn't necessarily, you know, hunting and fishing. It's bird watching. It's all kinds of outdoor activities. And then increased education and outreach to youth, families, and diverse communities about conservation and outdoor recreation. It'd be really nice if we could get our kids to quit doing this all the time and look up and see what's out there in our beautiful state of Oregon, and get them more involved in that, in recreation and outdoor activities throughout the state.
Fortunately, there are no cell towers in much of it.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, sir. So
Oh, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Just wanted to back up to that comment or that byline in here about connecting Oregonians to the outdoors, and then you have the education component here. And what comes to mind here is that I wonder if, you know, this isn't redundant, because we've got Travel Oregon that's doing some amazing stuff, incredibly successful stuff, as well as Oregon Park and Rec Commission. And Kenji actually serves with me on a task force called Outdoor Recreation Means Business at Oregon, that Travel Oregon is in the process right now of redefining their 10-year plan. And one of their bullets is the exact same thing you have here in terms of how do we provide better education about recreational opportunities throughout the state. And I just wonder if there isn't a way to collaborate with that effort so we don't have two parallel tracks. I understand you're primarily more hunting and fishing, but I wonder if anybody's thought about, could we not have another Travel Oregon initiative that could potentially try to fill that same niche that you're trying to do, and in the process do it more efficiently?
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, very good comments. It's not our intent to duplicate resources. I would hope that through the Revenue Committee or other bills, you could say, okay, if we're going to do this through outdoor, through Travel Oregon, we're going to tie ODFNW together, but it's definitely not the intent of this task force to propose two different funding sources.
I appreciate that.
Well said, and we should, all of you should take that to heart.
And maybe a question for ODFNW and for Travel Oregon is, does it make sense to work together on the issue that Representative Johnson just raised? I don't know the answer to that question, but it's something that we might want to ask.
I think we could. I'd be happy to pursue that.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
So we spent a lot of time looking at various options, and we wanted to make sure that the filter that we ran these options through was very onerous and how do I want to word this?
Comprehensive.
So was it sufficient? Did we provide sufficient funding? So we don't just solve the problem in the short run, and then you come back 2 years later, and there we go through the same thing again. We've got to raise hunting and fishing license fees, or because the agency's already made significant cuts in terms of personnel and dollars. Is it sustainable? Does it generate continuous dedicated funding? Is it stable and flexible? Is it going to fluctuate from year to year? Is it diverse and equitable? Does it spread the cost of fish and wildlife management, again, across a broader base rather than just on hunters and fishers? Enhancing diversity and engagement, does it affect and engage diverse and underrepresented individuals? Is it cost effective? Will it be easy to collect? How's it going to be administered and tracked? Is it defensible? Is there a connection between it? Is there a nexus between it? Is it, quote, politically feasible? Since we're a legislative committee, we try to put our hats on and put ourselves in your shoes. As an elected official for 12 years, I understand what politically feasible is about. We want to make sure that that if you take a hard vote on this, and you will be taking a lot of hard votes this legislative session, this one might be one that you could say, I'm willing to take a hard vote on this. Is it politically feasible? And is it insulated? Can it be diverted for other purposes? So we looked at, here's just a few of the options that we looked at. We actually looked at about 100 different options. And, of course, many of those options have been proposed before. But we did look, we said we need to take a hard look at all of them. And you can see there, marijuana tax, recreation tax, beverage container surcharge, wild bird seed tax, recreational vehicles, rental car fees, lodging fees, donations. We explored it all. And what we want to make sure that
was.
And this is clearly a high point of what I would like you all to know. Even though you're going to see the two recommendations that are up on the chart right now, we fully understand. We met with Representative Barnhart earlier this year, and he made it very clear to us. He thanked us for the two proposals, but he said, remember, it's up to the House Revenue Committee if you want to decide how you're going to fund this. We're not saying take it or leave it. You may come up with a better idea than we did. We spent a significant amount of time going over the various options for funding and running it through the filter, but we fully understand and fully appreciate that it's your role to dispose of these funding options. And if you have a better idea, we're fully engaged in that. So, Christine did cover these in some detail. This is the visual of that. It applies to individual. We came up with two ideas. Oregon individual Oregon income tax return surcharge applies to individual non-corporate tax returns, exemption for low-income filers. So a family of four, $100,000 taxable income would pay $42 more a year. The wholesale beverage surcharge, it's priced at the wholesale level, not at the retail level. So when Coke bottles it at the plant, sells it to Safeway, that's where the charge would become on. It wouldn't, and that's where the charge would become at the wholesale level. So at the 2.19% that Christine mentioned, on a six-pack of soda, it's 7 cents. On a six-pack of domestic beer, it's 11 cents. And a six-pack of microbrew, it's 19 cents. That's how the addition that it would add to that. So among the other recommendations, monitoring and reporting, this in our report, monitoring and reporting based on specific metrics, support the department's efforts to implement House Bill 3315, support national legislation and conservation program funding. There is a what they call a blue ribbon committee that has been working diligently. They have a bill introduced in Congress to provide some significant funding to fish and wildlife agencies nationwide. We've been monitoring that very closely. If that does provide some funding, that would be significantly help in this proposal. And so I can guarantee you I will be talking to Congressman Schrader and the friends of mine, Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley, to help support this bill at the national level. A variety of program adjustment recommendations. We looked at that because as it's not all about revenue increases, it's about fine-tuning the agency to make sure that they are the most efficient and effective. And as I've said, this will be my third time now, the agency did take significant cuts in the last legislative session when they had some financial issues, both in terms of personnel and in terms of dollars. And then a variety of partnering and leveraging recommendations. Maybe we can get some more help from some of the business communities like Columbia Sportswear and others to help provide some support for the agency. So in summary, our proposal establishes a conservation and recreation fund dedicated to expanding conservation efforts, improving hunting and fishing opportunities, connecting Oregonians with the outdoors. It works to solve the deferred maintenance efforts, dedicates a minimum of $87 million in new revenues, and eliminates future license fee increases. Those will go away under this proposal, and develops monitoring and reporting programs. We tried to do that in 15 minutes. We're getting pretty close. And did you find the mission?
I did. So Representative Beeler, the mission's pretty succinct. The mission of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is to protect and enhance Oregon's fish and wildlife and their habitats for use and enjoyment by present and future generations.
Thank you.
And then there are a variety of statutory directives go along with that.
Is it the right
mission? Been along with that. I would like you to take a couple more minutes and talk about the dilemma that the department faces that you explained to me and Representative Witt when we met with you in the conference room on the second floor a couple months ago, it seems to me. I think that understanding the dilemma that the department faces and how that impacts the mission of the department, I think is important for members of the legislature, including this committee, to understand. And I think the summary of it is the existing funding approach has run its string. It isn't going to work anymore. We got to do something else. Would you describe what the dilemma is now and why it is that you're coming to us with recommendations? I think that's something that the members need to know.
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, thank you. The funding source that ODF&W currently has is a nationwide funding source. When agencies were put together, they were essentially funded. It's a user pay system. If you want to go hunting and fishing, you pay for a license. If you want to take an animal, then you pay for a tag fee. And that worked for many years for hunting and fishing opportunities. But as time grew, the department was asked to provide more, quote, conservation type activities. And so where do you find the funding for that? The legislature didn't provide adequate funding to do those kinds of resources, so one of the places that they went to the last legislative session was to say, okay, we're going to raise hunting and fishing license fees in order to pay for some of these conservation efforts. And so there was some blowback from hunters and fishers, but the legislature did pass that, and those fee increases were put into place. And so this is an opportunity to say the hunters and fishers of the state recognize that they need to make a major contribution to funding the agency. But we also are saying all Oregonians cherish and value ODF&W's mission and conservation activities, so all Oregonians should be helping to support the agencies and help pay for that. And so that's the angle that we took, was how do we help the agency with funding from all Oregonians, not putting it just on the backs of hunters and fishers. Anything to add there?
I might add that this user pay model is basically consumptive wildlife uses. And it's the non-consumptive wildlife uses that have been growing exponentially, and particularly among urbanites wanting to bird watching, hike, et cetera. Those folks in this current model are not being asked to pay for the department to manage the resources that they are enjoying.
And a lot of other state agencies also ask for resources. I'll give you an example in Tillamook County, where I'm very familiar with that. When we do culvert replacements on county roads, we ask ODF&W to come out and provide guidance and assistance on what size of culvert for fish passage. Do we adequately fund that for them to do that kind of activities? Probably not. The conservation activities, maybe there's opportunities there for potential funding sources from counties and cities and other uses. And I think you've looked into that a little bit.
So. Representative Mueller, please.
Yeah, so when other agencies request your expertise in professional review, why don't you bill for those services like other agencies do?
So if we could ask.
So, Director, last session, the legislature passed House Bill 3315, which directed the department to assess what the costs are for providing these resources to other agencies, and they're in the midst of doing that. But we have department representatives here who could probably better answer the current status of that effort.
Can we call them up?
Yeah, please. Yeah, that was your hint.
didn't want to be presumptive and show up on the dais if I was not invited by the chair. Well, thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And Mr. Owens was correct. In the last legislative session, House Bill 3315 was passed. It does give us, beginning in 2019, it gives us the authority to begin to bill other executive branch agencies for our participation in their regulatory processes. So if, for instance, just to cite an example, every water right or water right transfer requires, I mean, it's a requirement that we review and sign off on the transfer, the department does. And so beginning in 2019, we will be able to bill for that activity. These other non-regulatory processes where I think Commissioner Labhart mentioned where we consult with, for instance, county road departments as they're replacing culverts, there's no, we would not, under this bill, House Bill 3315, we do not have the ability to bill for those activities. But nonetheless, we do and will begin to do that in 2019.
Do you have an estimate of how much revenue that will generate for the department?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bueller, interesting, until very recently, the answer to that question is no. We do not code our time. We've never been in an environment where we actually tracked our employees' time really on a billable, you know, at that finite resolution. However, as part of House Bill 3315, and also just as part of our effort to improve the management of our resources, we now have a system in place where we are tracking that. So here very shortly, we're going to be able to start producing estimates for the other agencies to let them know what the magnitude of this cost is. Mm-hmm. I think when I testified on this bill 2 years ago, House Bill 3315, I think I said that you know, we're the agency of information. That's what we do, but we don't have a lot of information on the specific, you know, task-specific work that our field staff accomplishes. And we have done some very cursory analyses over the years, really based more on anecdote than real hard science. And I felt, and I think I'm on the record as saying, that the cost per biennium is probably between $50,000 and $500,000 per biennium. But we don't know. We will know very shortly. And I do believe it is going to be in that range. It's probably going to be on the lower end of the range as well. But
got it. Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Thank you for your hard work. I, having led a work group myself, I know that it can be a long, arduous task, and I'm really impressed with the amount, the kind of clear, linear way that you guys worked, and the fact that you tried to go beyond where you were used to working with and come up with new ideas. So I'm just looking at the slide about the more than 100 options considered, and just wondered if you could talk a little bit about where, how you got to the decision of the two options that you did come up with. Because honestly, looking at that, to me, there are things with more of a nexus to this than what you ended up picking. I mean, like particularly like the RV tag, you know, it may be that that ended up being something that had to go to the highway fund or whatever. But I just wondered how you did get to those two.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, it was a hard, arduous task. When we looked at like the RV, in some cases, it didn't produce enough revenue. You know, one that was a pretty easy one to look at was recommended by the chair of the Fish and Wildlife Commission was, I just got back from Florida. That's why I'm so tan. I was down there visiting a grandchild for a month. So that's why I'm so tan. So, but when I rented a car down there, I paid a car rental fee, and there was like four different taxes that the state of Florida put on there. And it was like there was a fee for this and a fee for that and a fee for that. Well, we looked at that too. We thought, well, this is easy. We'll just have the tourists pay for these. But it didn't bring in hardly any revenue at all. And so we looked at that and filtered it with all of those other criteria. And so, and I can tell you, there is controversy. There are some probably some lobbyists in this room that don't like what they see on the two that were proposed. But I can tell you, we as a committee, when you have the Oregon Hunters Association with some environmental groups all signing this document and saying we support this, that says a lot when they know that we spent a lot of time trying to come up with the best solution that we could. But clearly we heard you, Representative Barnhart, clearly that this isn't leave it, or you know, if you come up with some other sources, that's more power to you. But we did spend every month a considerable amount of time with the 17 members of our committee and Senator Edwards and Senator Whitsitt and Representative Krieger and Representative Helm working our way through these proposals.
And Representative, I'll add that early on we did look at a patchwork of sources, you know, Christmas tree type approach, and we immediately abandoned that. Because each one of those has its own set of legal and political challenges. And so the task force decided early on that the recommendations would come to you as being adequate to generate the revenue that we felt was needed.
Thank you.
Yes, and Jim Martin just reminded me, we did look at other states, and the best representative was the state of Missouri, and they actually fund it from sales tax down there. So, of course, the other states have a sales tax, and we don't, so we had to look at other sources. But we really researched what other states are doing, because life's too short not to steal good ideas from other people. Mm-hmm. So that's what we did, was we tried to look at what other states are doing and looking at their funding sources, too, as we helped develop this proposal.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for all the work. It really was a lot of work, we can tell. One of the challenges in supporting a dedicated funding mechanism is the loss of the discipline imposed by people like Representative Smith sitting over to my right here on Ways and Means, because, of course, they're going to demand proof of your achievement of certain standards of performance, which would not happen. I saw you addressed it up there, but one always wonders. There's nothing like, I'm guessing, going, well, actually, I've gone before Ways and Means, and getting grilled by those people about how well and how or how poorly you're doing, that discipline would be lacking in any dedicated arrangement. Explain to us why I shouldn't be concerned.
Well, Representative, one of our recommendations is that if you approve this funding approach, that there be an oversight group created that would specifically track and report to you on how the revenues are being spent. Are they indeed being spent for the purposes that have been outlined here? So that was our primary approach to address your question.
Thank you.
Are you planning to present the bones of this proposal, report, maybe not including the slides on revenue options, but the other issues to the Ways and Means Committee or one of its subcommittees? Is that part of your plan?
Chair Barnhart, no, we have not been asked to do that.
Okay. So. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. Just to follow up to Representative Bent's question, do you have key performance metrics? And if so, can you share those with us for the last several years?
Representative, no, we did not develop those. We frankly ran out of time to do that, but we have a recommendation that they be developed in the first biennium of passage of this, that be an initial activity that's undertaken. So that was a specific recommendation by the task force.
So to clarify, the agency does not in the past develop these performance metrics?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Buehler, no, we absolutely do have key performance metrics that we do track through our Ways and Means and budget process, just not for this program that was described here by the task force folks.
Yes, please. Go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Did you – I know the – at least my impression is that the agency – holds significant assets, property assets around the state. Did you look at the ability to sell any of those assets that are become an excessive liability or not used?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Buehler, the task force did not look at that particular issue. We as an agency have looked at it over time. Most of our We do own about approximately 230,000 acres in the form mostly of wildlife management areas. And most of those wildlife management areas were purchased with federal funds, Pittman-Robertson funds from the sale of excise tax on arms and ammunition. And as such, they're not necessarily liquid assets for us. If we were to divest in them, we would have to return the money to the federal government. However, there are examples, and we did sell 600 acres of timber in Coos, Douglas County, down near Eel Lake several years ago. So we have looked at where we have surplus properties, and we have liquidated where we could if they were purchased with state dollars, licensed dollars, as opposed to federal funds that are restricted.
Yes, please.
Uh-huh. And then there's a lot of nonprofit and other entities that do similar type of work in the state. Have you ever looked at the ability of contracting out some of your services to these nonprofits that could be able to deliver it probably less labor costs specifically than what your agency can do?
Well, Chair Barnhart and Representative Buehler, we do have, for instance, in this package, and recognizing that this package that the task force developed has a long ways to go. There's a lot of decisions and discussions to occur before any even if the funding mechanism is determined and passed, there's still a lot of discussions and to occur in terms of what the actual program is. Mm-hmm. And I think the task force did actually contemplate that some of those services would and could be provided not by agency staff but by other entities, by partners, conservation groups, and or nonprofits. When it comes to contracting out, of course, we are ODFW is an SEIU represented agency, so we look very carefully at any decisions as it relates to contracting out work for our staff that are currently completing those jobs or currently doing those jobs right now.
So, do you get an estimate of how when you did look at the jobs that you felt like you could do in a contracting out situation? Do you get an estimate of how much that would save the agency?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Buehler, we did not have anywhere near that depth of analysis in this task force process.
All right. Thank you. And very good. Thank you so much for bringing this report, for the work that you did in order to produce it, For informing the committee of the dilemma that the department and the Oregon conservation effort faces. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll close the information meeting on the Fish and Wildlife Revenue Task Force and ask the Department of Revenue for its 911 report. Thank you all for coming today to be here at this meeting. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Would you like me to begin, or would you like Kyle?
I think we'll let Kyle give us a quick introduction, and then we'll go.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. Yes. The next setup we have here is for the informational hearing related to a report that the Department of Revenue is required to do in a legislation, House Bill 4055 of 2014, and it's relating to the emergency communications, the 911 tax. So there were some changes made in an effort to facilitate administration and collection of the E-911 tax receipts. They were made in 2014. Included in that is a reporting requirement of the Department of Revenue to report on how those changes have affected their ability to collect the 911 receipts. I do have a quick background document. It is up there in OLS just to give a quick overview of the 911 tax. It's what you see up there on the screen. I'll try to be really brief to not steal any talking points from the Department of Revenue. but just to go over how the tax is set up right now, the 911 tax is a tax imposed on each consumer and paying retail subscriber that has access to the 911 reporting system. There's really two buckets in how the tax is imposed. You can think of the one as prepaid wireless telecommunications. So those are wireless, so you can think of a cell phone that doesn't have a long-term contract. So it could be a month-to-month contract, or it could be other cases where you're able to load minutes via a card or just load minutes to your phone. So there's two ways or multiple ways where you can fit into that prepaid wireless. And then everything that's not prepaid wireless is taxed on a monthly basis per subscriber line, so 75 cents per month. And that compares to the prepaid wireless, which is 75 cents per transaction. So in many cases, that will still be once a month, but in other cases where someone adds minutes to their phone, maybe twice a month, they would be charged 75 cents two times that month. So that's one thing to keep in mind. If you scroll down a little bit further, I just have a chart that shows some of the national subscriptions by type. This is for national. It goes back to 2009, but it just does a good job of showing the changes in the type of services that people are using. So you can see the red bar there is the traditional wireline phone. That was 32% of all subscriptions back in 2009. It's down to 15% in 2015. And you can see the uptick in the mobile, which is both prepaid wireless and postpaid, and then also the voice over internet protocol, the VoIP. So it's just, it kind of shows that, I guess, sets up the department why some of the enhancements, if you will, that were in 4055 were required. The last thing I would just point out is on the second page of the document, and it's just the receipts. The 911 receipts by fiscal year, and you can see that uptick in the 15-16 fiscal year that does correspond with the timing of some of these changes. And with that, I think that hopefully sets up in part why the department's here.
Great. Good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack with the Department of Revenue. And I just want to alert you to the fact that some people may have seen online that we had a report that did not contain the executive summary. I did let Kyle know we posted the wrong version. Maybe we send it to you, but we do have one with an executive summary, which we'll replace with the correct one, so do look for that later. So Kyle did explain a lot about the kind of the overview of the tax. It is a tax that's imposed on the consumer. And it is collected by the Department of Revenue, and then we transfer the proceeds from it to the Office of Emergency Communications, and they distribute it then to local governments for the use in their 911 centers around the state. The tax provides about 24% of the total revenues. The rest of it comes from property tax revenues. So 4055 was passed in 2014 as a result of We were looking for clarity in whether prepaid wireless specifically was included in your definition of wireless. We worked with telecommunication providers, local governments, and then various policymakers to get the clarity that we needed in this bill. As a part of that, we do have a report that we're required to bring back to you. In that change, there was what we call a transitional tax, where providers agreed to voluntarily pay the tax on prepaid wireless for a 9-month window in 2015 before it became collected at the point of sale during the transaction. So the report that we're required to present to you talks about the collection of the taxes at the point of sale for the prepaid wireless services. The effectiveness of the statutes enforced by the department in collecting the tax from consumers and subscribers with access to the 911 systems, and an estimate of the revenue received on or after October 1st, 2015, that is attributable to the provisions of House Bill 4055. The report submitted to you describes taxes on prepaid wireless collected at the point of sale, also the quarterly tax revenue from first quarter 2014 to third quarter 2016, and our efforts. Before, like Kyle said, before the law changed, telecommunications providers were solely responsible for collecting and reporting the tax of 75 cents per month. Now retailers and sellers are also reporting and collecting the tax since October of 2015. It's held in trust, and then it's transmitted to the department by the last day of the month following each calendar quarter. Prior to House Bill 4055, there were approximately 170 telecommunication providers collecting and reporting the tax, with the requirement to increase that to retailers. The number is just over 300 now, with approximately 150 retailers or sellers also reporting. So although the changes resulting from House Bill 4055 began with first quarter of 2015, which was January through March, we felt it was important to also include the receipts from the first quarter of 2014 forward for comparison for you before the law changes. So on page 6 of the report, figure 1, you're going to see that the tax receipts were $9.8 million for the first quarter of 2014. And they've slowly increased to $10.7 million in the third quarter of 2016. There are noticeable increases at each of the two law changes, a 2.4% increase in the first quarter of 2015 and a 3.2% increase in the fourth quarter of 2015. Those are both changes in when people were supposed to start filing differently than they had in the past. Nearly 15% of the total tax receipts in third quarter were 2016 were attributable to prepaid wireless transactions. So we can't identify specifically how much of that increased revenue is a result of this legislation, because there were some providers that were paying tax on prepaid wireless prior to the legislation. So there, it's no way for us to actually drill down that narrowly. So on page 7, figure 2 charts tax return data showing a slight decrease in traditional landline and subscription wireless accesses, which is consistent with the report, with the graph that Kyle just showed you. While prepaid wireless transactions are continuing to increase, people are shutting down their landlines and just moving straight to mobile. Mm-hmm. I've done that. I don't know about you, but many of us have. So industry research that the use of prepaid wireless continues to increase at a rate faster than traditional subscription wireless service. So as to the effectiveness of the statute, comparing our data to information that we have through the Public Utility Commission's regulatory data and our tax return data, of course, we believe that most of the large telecommunication providers are compliant with tax collection and reporting requirements. Many of the large brick and mortar stores also are, and about 20 online retailers. And these people represent a bulk of the people that are actually paying the tax, right? So we've got a large number of a large amount of compliance in that area, but then there's that window that we still have to do some work in. So we continue to pursue enforcement activities with the providers and brick and mortar retailers who aren't complying with the filing requirements. And we're working with to identify and obtain compliance from retailers that have an online presence, which is our most challenging compliance issue to address, is typical with most sales tax type items. So our filing enforcement efforts have included educating taxpayers where we see that they maybe they filed one quarter and then they didn't file the next quarter because they just didn't understand they had a quarterly filing requirement. So we're trying to teach them about that. There's some of these folks are new to it. We sent about 300 letters to providers that or retailers we believe that are subject. We think that they're selling these cards or these items in their stores. We've received 84 returns as a result of that effort, and we've also learned from some of them that they just aren't subject to it, so we've taken them off the list, and then the rest we've issued failure to file assessments on. Follow-up for returns from prepaid we follow up from returns from other prepaid wireless retailers that so we're doing some cross-referencing between, and we've done a couple of audits that just had a small adjustment and some single period audit that had about a $46,000 adjustment. So the program area, the administrative challenges that we have in this particular program is that first that there's no common or central place for us to identify who is selling prepaid wireless services. There's no registry or anything along those lines, so we have to go out and notice it. We do, when we have staff out in locations, we do take note of whether a retailer is also selling these cards. If our tobacco inspectors are out and they see the product online, then we'll use that as a source as well. The second area is enforcing the tax that's to be collected and remitted by online retailers who do not have a physical presence here in Oregon. That's a difficult one to enforce. The third relates to confusion about by taxpayers about when they are entitled to claim the 2% reimbursement. So you enacted for the retailers who are collecting the tax on prepaid wireless, they can take 2%, remit net 2% with the 2% difference to offset their cost. But that doesn't apply to other types of people who are collecting. Bless you. And there's finally, as we pointed out in September, an inconsistency in the way the interest is calculated on refunds for this particular program. And we did mention that in September, and I do believe that's what House Bill 2050 is addressing. So that bill, I believe, would change the interest start date to align with our other tax programs.
Okay.
So right now, actual collections are on track to exceed revenue projections, about $83.9 million for the 2015-17 biennium. And we do now have fourth quarter receipts. They are steady with third quarter receipts at about $10.7 million. So it does appear that compliance is improving based on our initial analysis so far. And we know that there's still room for improvement, and we're continuing to work through, you know, filing enforcement and audits to learn more about the impact of the legislative changes. So if you have any questions about the report or my presentation.
Great, thank you. For those who were not here, I'll note that this was a big issue, hotly contested, involved a lot, and it just as a quick review of this report, it appears that if we had not done it, our revenues would be down quite a bit from what they actually are. So even though the revenues are only up $500,000, well, I think, what is it, $900,000, instead it would be down quite substantially if you review the chart you showed us on the change in the mix. And the interesting part to me is that the change in the mix shows a significant decline in subscribed wireless systems.
That is interesting.
That is, apparently those people are using more prepaid. Those almost mirror each other. Are there any questions about the report? Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. And with that, we'll move on from our information meeting to the public hearing on House Bill 2050. We'll open that public hearing. Kyle, do you want to give us the introduction?
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as the department was just mentioned in their report, House Bill 2050 deals with the timing of interest computation on refunds for both the 911 program, and then it's also for the lodging tax as well. So in reviewing and some of the work that they've done in some of the new prepaid wireless, the department discovered some of the differences in how interest is computed, and then they found that also was an existing law for the lodging tax program. So that's why the change would be in both of the programs. But what you see in House Bill 2050 is what it's doing is it's changing the timing or how the interest or when the interest begins computing or collecting or accruing, I should say. So the way that the law is set up now under existing law is interest, and this is for excess payments. So if a taxpayer pays $10,000 and it turns out their tax liability is $9,000, it'd be that $1,000 excess payment that would have to be refunded back with interest. So it's the timing and the the accruing of that interest that's in House Bill 2050. But so under existing law, the way interest or when the interest actually begins accruing begins with the date of the payment, so the date of the tax payment, and then when the date of the refund actually goes out. So if a taxpayer makes a payment, say January 1, and then the refund goes out at the end of the month, you would be accruing interest for that entire month. What's different here from some of the other tax programs and what the department mentioned was when a payment comes in, unless the department has received the return that goes with it, the department doesn't know whether or not an excess payment has even been made. They don't know what the tax liability is.
Okay.
So the change in House Bill 2050 would make the timing of when the interest clock begins, if you will, to being 45 days after the due date of the return or when the excess payment was made. So in case the payment came in late, you don't start the clock at the time the return was supposed to come in. And the 45-day window, if you will, basically allows 45 days for the Department of Revenue to refund the excess payment without paying any interest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's after that 45-day window, and that does line up with the income tax, the personal income tax program, and some of the others as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the change there. It does get a 3/5 requirement from LC, so that's something to keep in mind.
But they have a reason to
Oh, yes. Okay.
So, but that's the change, and it would be to both the 911 and the lodging tax programs.
Right. Right. Does the department want to be heard on that? Are there any other witnesses on this bill? No. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and Kyle did an excellent job explaining what we discovered. We discovered this as part of the administration when we were processing 911 tax returns, and people started claiming refunds for that 2% net. They didn't realize that they were owed, that they could withhold that for themselves, and so they said, oh, well, amend the return. And so we figured the interest goes back that far, and that is inconsistent with all our other tax programs. We just wanted to point that out to you to make sure you were aware of that and whether you wanted to align it or leave it intentionally that way.
What is the interest rate that the department has to pay?
Right now, Mr. Chair, the interest rate, I believe, is 5% for delinquencies or refunds, deficiencies, delinquencies, or refunds that accrue on or after January 1 of 2017.
Okay.
So it's 5%.
So if I were a small vendor and I was getting a quarter of 1%, on my savings account at the bank, I might do very well to
pay my tax.
Send the money to you and have you send me 5% when you refunded it.
Mr. Chair, that is certainly something.
No one's figured that out yet, I hope.
Well, you did.
Down the bank now.
It is based, our interest rate is based on the federal rate. We're one
sure.
point higher than the federal rate.
Of course.
The
rate's reasonable. It isn't the rate that's the question. It's the question of when should it accrue.
Right.
And that's what this bill is about, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
CD for that.
Any questions?
True, you can.
Any questions for the department? Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And colleagues, I apologize. I am new to this committee. When I read the staff measure summary, it talks about the interest is computed at a rate of 5/6 of 1% per month, or a fraction thereof, equaling 10% per year.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Is it 10%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the statute sets forth the rate. It's been in existence for a long time. It is 10% per year. But it also goes on to explain that the department by rule must also adjust that rate in line with federal rates. And so we do that on an annual basis. Every the third quarter rate, federal, they post it in about Memorial Day for the third quarter, and we do an evaluation at that point for the subsequent tax year. So right now it is 5%.
So is 10% the ceiling?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, there is no ceiling. It has been higher than 10% in the past.
Is there a floor?
Mr. Chair, no. And Representative Smith, there is not a floor.
We'll get Kyle to restate the SMS so that it's accurate. I think what you're saying is that the statute set an initial rate.
Correct.
And the department was required then to adjust the rate based on these other factors you described.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And we've been doing that, I believe, since 1969.
Okay. And it's that latter piece that got left out of the SMS.
Right. Perhaps, yes. Okay. I didn't notice that.
We'll ask Kyle to bring that up to date so that we've got that up to date. Any other questions? If I understand it right, what you're really trying to do is to say we would like to have the interest rate run from the date at which we actually have an opportunity to figure out whether we owe a refund or not, and 45 days after that date.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that is exactly the intent of the rest of the provisions in the tax laws that we administer.
But that's what this bill does, isn't
Correct.
It? Okay. All right. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you. I guess I have kind of a ways and means question on this.
Please, go ahead.
What if the department's not operating efficiently and the business owners or the citizens' tax return is being held up, not through any fault of their own, but because it's taking excessive time to get to that point to determine it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, that is why there's a 45-day cap on that, because once we pass that 45 days, the legislature has said it's reasonable for you to take 45 days to receive it, post it, get the return processed, and out the door. But if you go beyond that, then interest does begin on that 45th day. And if it takes us, say, a year to process that refund, they will get all of that interest after that 45th day.
Makes perfect sense to me.
And then Ways and Means will have something to say about it.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Right. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? All right. It's not up for today, but I'm hoping I can schedule this one soon. Okay. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2050. Colleagues, I think we have exhausted our agenda for the day. Please note I'm giving you 35 minutes. Spend them wisely.
No.
We're very appreciative.
We have more. Wait. Did I mess up?
Oh, man,
we're gonna. Sorry. I messed up. I'm trying to avoid listening to Paul for another.
I thought he gabbled out. I heard the gavel hit.
No, it didn't. No, gavel didn't hit.
Didn't you hear it out there?
You see?
Oh.
Yes. All right.
Professor Warner is going to come up to the.
Professor Warner is going to come and enlighten us some more. And I will say that if Professor Warner doesn't finish today, if he doesn't finish today, we will carry this forward to Monday. And Monday is going to be a very interesting day, because Monday we hear from the CPAs about reconnect with the federal system. And if you think the information he provides you is interesting, the information on Monday will be vastly more so.
There's a teaser.
Thank you for saving me. I appreciate that.
Yes. Yeah. And I have a feeling that you'll come back to tax reform. It will not be resolved this weekend, my guess.
Right.
I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I did want to kind of finish the discussion you've had this week around the alternative business tax options with giving you some numbers and applying them to Oregon. These are not anything recommended, or certainly not a limit of how high or how low it could go. It's just to give you some examples and to really put the Oregon numbers in the context of the bases you've been talking about, and getting at that issue of, okay, how much do we generate from these different bases? What if we were to apply them in Oregon? So I'll just walk through these with you and make sure that this the numbers are clear to you, and then this will be kind of at that point what our intent is. Chris and I have been working on kind of information requests that you've made during the discussion this week, and getting back to you at some point in the future, and then to kind of develop a list of policy options or policy decisions you would have to make if you make some structural changes. So the first block I have there is on net corporate income tax, and the first line in that block, and it goes by fiscal year, and then it goes by biennium. So these are the current law estimates. These are the corporate income tax forecast estimates in your December forecast, which you'll get updated next week. So the current Oregon forecast corporate income tax at 6.6 and 7.6 generates around $500 million a year. And so you can see the projection for this biennium is a little over $1 billion. And the outlook from the state economist is it's going to remain relatively flat. And, of course, we've talked about over time the corporate income tax has been declining as a share of revenue, as a share of the economy. The other thing to keep in mind, the state economist is projecting basically trend growth. If you were to see a recession, those corporate numbers would drop dramatically. We typically see 35-40% drops in net corporate income tax revenue. If you look at the next two lines, these are estimates of what you would generate at a 9% rate for all net corporate income. These are not revenue impact estimates because they're just how much would be generated. So the impact estimate would be the difference between the two lines. And then you can see, and we put this in so you could compare what you'd raise from the other broader base is a 20% corporate rate, and we're not proposing that in any way, but a 20% corporate rate would generate about, if you look at the biennium as a whole, about $2.9 billion for the biennium. So that gives you an idea of that base, and of course, again, as we've talked about, that's a relatively narrow base. Now, the next set of things is what we've been working on around a business privilege tax. So a business privilege tax is most of our estimates really come from scaling Ohio's data because we have very detailed data from Ohio. So we kind of use this first block uses some of the Ohio base numbers, a $1 million threshold. So you pay $150 minimum, and then above a million, you pay 0.26 in Ohio. Our first row there, we're looking at a 0.25, so pretty much analogous to the Ohio example. As we also talked about, Ohio exempts nonprofits, so that's taken out of our base, too, as we mimic the Ohio base. That doesn't mean you have to go that way. It's just for the numbers' sake. So the first column, 17, 18, the numbers are relatively small compared to the next fiscal year for all of these. That's because we assume you start on 1/1/18. And that you get to roughly 40% of the annual estimate for that first 6 months. It'll be the last 6 months of that fiscal year. So that's why you see smaller numbers in 17, 19, for example. So the next two rows, they keep a constant, the threshold and the filing threshold, but then just raise the rate. So if you look, for example, and they're roughly proportional, or pretty close to being proportional. So, for example, if you had a 0.25% business privilege tax for the full 1921 biennium. It would be in place for 24 months. And you had those thresholds, you'd raise about $1.5 billion. And then, of course, if you were to go to the highest rate, the 0.75, you'd get about three times that amount, or about $4.5 billion. So that gives you a sense of the magnitude. Again, there's nothing to say you can't have a 0.8 rate or a 0.2 rate. So, in other words, go outside there. It's just to give you some examples of what those numbers would look like. The other thing is if you're thinking about replacing your current primary business tax, the corporate income tax, you would have to subtract those numbers. So if you go on a net revenue impact, for example, on a 0.75% business privilege tax with a $1 million threshold, for 1921 it would be $4.5 billion, and then you'd have to subtract about $1.1 billion from that if you were to eliminate or repeal the corporate income tax at the same time. So the net would be about $3.4 billion. So that would be how, and again, those are decisions for you to make. Now you can also see the rate, obviously, is a huge decision. Another one is where do you set that threshold for when the rate kicks in? And that's where those next two blocks do. It keeps those, looks at the same three rates, and then you start with a $5 million rate, or a $5 million threshold, meaning that you're going to pay, in this example, you're going to pay $150 up to sales up to $5 million, and then above $5 million, then you pay the rates. So you can see, again, what the impact is in this example. So if you look at, for example, the 0.75% rate, and for 1921, compared with the $5 million threshold versus the $1 million, you can see the difference is about $4.5 billion versus about $3.9 billion. So about a $600 million difference from going from the $1 million threshold to the $5 million. So, again, that's a huge policy parameter. And then the next block does the same thing, only with a $10 million threshold. So then what you're saying is anybody with sales with in Oregon that less than $10 million would pay $150. Now, of course, that's another policy decision you'd have. You can set the minimum whenever you want. You can structure it. And as you saw, for example, in Ohio, they do have a tiered minimum. So once you get over $1 million, they have a minimum that is calculated up to $2,500. So that's, again, something you can do. But this is just assuming $150 minimum, and also the filing threshold could be adjusted. So that gives you an idea of what those revenues look like. The other comparison we have is the value-added base. We're not as confident in these estimates. We basically use some of the ratios we talked about, the relationship between the value-added tax and the gross receipts tax to generate these estimates. So we're looking at a $1 million threshold for value-added tax. Remember, this is a different kind of a measure, so it's more narrow than sales. So a $1 million threshold would be harder to get over. But you can see what a 1% rate would generate and for a full biennium for 1921, for example, generate about $2.1 billion. So, again, this is a 1% rate, which is higher than any of the gross receipts rates that you see. The ratio there is a little over 3 between the two. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you see what the 1.5% rate would generate. So, again, you can compare these bases. One comparison to make, for example, with a corporate base, looking at the 20% rate, it's about $2.9 billion for 1921. Well, you would generate more than that from a 0.5% gross receipts tax. You can generate $3 billion instead of $2.9 billion with a 0.5% rate versus a 20% rate. And again, that's the narrowness and the breadth of the base that determine that. So that's what I wanted to kind of leave you with to think about over the weekend. That's just to kind of follow up on what it would actually translate into in these bases that we've talked about. And, of course, if you're thinking in terms of overall revenue reform, there's a whole myriad of things that could be added to this, changes in the other taxes as well. So, but this is to give you kind of a starting point of a menu of what you would generate from these different basis.
Thank you.
I think I kind of got a little lost when you were explaining it. Do the numbers that you're showing us here assume a change in the corporate income tax, or this is in addition to? I got a little lost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose. Yeah, these are not, I'm not intending these to be proposals. These are just showing what you would generate if you had this base in place.
Okay.
So one obvious option would be to say, okay, well, if we're going to do a business privilege tax, then we ought to eliminate the corporate income tax. You don't have to do that. That's not, there's not necessarily required. Remember, we talked about New Hampshire has a value-added tax, but they also have a business profits tax.
Okay.
So you can do both. But if you were to eliminate the corporate income tax, so again, if you look at the 1921 numbers, and you said you wanted a 0.75% business privilege tax with a $1 million threshold, you raise about $4.5 billion from that privilege tax, but then you'd lose $1.1 from eliminating the corporate income tax as it currently operates. So you'd have a net of $3.4
billion. Got it. Okay.
Other yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Paul and Chris, for all of this work. And this is, I'm sure, the first of trillions of these tables we'll be asking you for. Let me ask you a couple questions. The first is, it just occurred to me, if we were to switch to either a privilege tax or a value-added tax, how would that impact any efforts on transparency? Because I feel like it would, because it kind of feels like a big part of why we talk about this versus the corporate tax is because there are so many ways to manipulate a corporate tax in a way that right now, at the start, until, as we discussed the other day, 10 or 20 years from now, it's a pretty clean thing to do. And it would be fairly, I would assume, more easy to figure out what everybody's paying. So you might not have an answer to that, but I just wanted to get your thoughts.
Well, Madam Vice Chair and Mr. Chair, a couple of obvious things. One is if you eliminated the corporate income tax, you wouldn't have that link to the federal returns. So, and that does influence a lot of what you can do in terms of disclosure, as you've looked at, I think, in the past, because, the pretty clear message we've gotten from legal advice, both the AG and the Legislative Council, is you don't have the authority to disclose something that's on the federal return, even
right.
though they're filing, they're including their federal return when they file it, their state return. You only have influence over the state return.
Right.
And then, of course, you run into this thing, can you derive the federal numbers from the state return and those kinds of risks? So that connection point is a big inhibitor of disclosure. And that's just a practical matter. And obviously, the Department of Revenue has to maintain the IRS standards, or they're going to lose their ability to share data with them. So this means you'd be looking at, for example, a business privilege tax. You would generally be looking at something that was a state return. You saw the one-page form, so there would be a state control. The only thing I could think of, the gross receipts would tend to appear on a federal form, but I suspect that would not be a disclosure issue. I think that would be, my first reaction would be that would be the state's, that would be under the state's purview as to what that disclosure was, but I don't want to get too far into legal.
Sure,
because
thank you. And then another,
the
other, and maybe I'll say them both so that you know them. Number one is, to be clear, any other work we might do on where we attach to the federal, that's more individual based, so that wouldn't be impacted by this, like whether we allow all the federal, you know, allowances on second mortgages and the amount, you know, limits on the amount of mortgage introduction. That would all be outside of this because that is all tied to individual.
Yes,
is that correct?
That's correct. I think you would have control of the state return. Probably a little bit less so on the value added, because if you look at the BED form, those lines that are on the BED form would be the same as you would see on a corporate tax return. Mm-hmm. But again, those would be state only. So I suspect you'd have a lot more flexibility in that area too.
Okay. And then my last one is just, I think you said this, but some of the questions we did ask about, you know, could you figure out at what percentage would it move, say, the proportion of taxes paid by corporations versus individuals? Like, what would it be to have it at the 6% it is now, at the 18% it's been in the past, and something in between? Mm-hmm. So that's stuff that you either can or are working on?
Madam Vice Chair, yes, there's a couple of issues. The numbers you're citing, really the corporate as a percentage of general fund. Well, obviously, now, if you take that literally, if you eliminated the corporate return, that would go to zero, but then you would replace it with this other business tax. So we could look at how that would compare. I would suggest, too, that you could look at the cost study that had all the business taxes and see where you end up with some proposed change. Imposing whatever change numbers you have on it, assuming the rest of the states stay the same, see where, how that would affect your relative position.
You mean that's the 0.8 to 1, the return numbers or other numbers from that?
Well, that's
the, one.
That's the spending plus the revenue. But I'm just thinking of that more in terms of the percentage of the economy. Remember that the federal national is about 4.6, the state's about 3.6. So that might be one comparison. Again, it doesn't mean that's the right number for you necessarily.
No,
it's just a comparative thing for you to look at, and we could certainly do those kind of things.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Representative
Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. So, Paul, I just want to check my math here. So, and this is very helpful, so thank you very much. So if we doubled the corporate net income tax, we still wouldn't fill the projected state budget deficit. Is that correct?
I think you would just about do it for 17-19 if you were to go from the 6.676, the current projection, up to a 20%, which is more than double.
That's more than double. So if we doubled, what would it?
Well, you go from $1.03 billion up to 2.9, so you would collect about 1.8, which is pretty close to what the LFO estimate is.
If we could collect it.
Yes. Well, and then you notice in the fine print down below, Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, if you look at the fine print down below, all revenue estimates are static, meaning that there's no behavioral response. So we would assume if you were to go to a 20% corporate, you would get some feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not immediately, but you would get some feedback.
Feedback.
Right. That would put Oregon's tax and the federal tax together at more than half of the profits.
Yes.
Interesting. All right. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for all this work. Paul, you had mentioned pyramiding yesterday, and there's a tendency to think that the 0.25 rate is all that someone at the bottom of the pyramid would pay, raise the top of the pyramid, whatever's the bad end of the pyramid to be on. Can you take us through that? And one I'm interested in you using is fuel, since we're talking about the transportation package. But what would a person expect to pay if we had this tax at 0.25 rate as they drive up to the pump? Assume three layers of folks to get the gas in the pump.
Yeah. Well, you could think of, Mr. Vice Chair, you could think of those nominal rates. And if, you know, normally, of course, the way things work in the real world is you don't see 100% shifting. You see some portion of that. So, but assuming that you did see that built in and, say, a tripling through the pyramid process, then you're looking at about, you know, 0.75% that would get built into the overall prices instead of the 0.25, and assuming that that ended up at the pump. So you would see, you know, an increase of around less than 1%.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
So when I had this conversation years ago, when someone started a rumor there was going to be an increase in the beer tax, I was informed unequivocally by various people in the beer tax chain that it was a nickel, a proposed increase, that it wouldn't be a nickel. It would instantly be more because they would put their markup on top of the nickel, and thus the nickel plus markup, then another nickel plus that markup, and by the time it finally got down to whoever was drinking the beer, it was pretty noticeable. There was no doubt about it, transparency issues. I mean, you would know. So one of the big problems of this particular tax is that some think it might be invisible, but others not at all. So can you share with me, will your studies reflect to us that kind of possibility that you're going to present us with so that we can still go into a local bar without running the risk of
yes.
being attacked?
We do.
Yeah.
Mr. Vice Chair, LRL staff always ask, if you are serious about raising the beer tax, please let us know so we can stock up.
But excuse me, if I may interrupt. This would raise the beer tax. This is a beer tax increase. I just want to make it really clear.
Yes.
Or unless we're going to carve beer out.
It would be for the privilege of selling beer, yes. 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 But this is a very serious issue, Mr. Vice Chair. I agree with you that the pyramiding is, as we've talked about, is the number one criticism, I think, of the gross receipts tax, and why you see it cost, for example, is generally opposes gross receipts tax, and so does the tax foundation for that reason. But still, you're looking at it, a lot of it depends on kind of at what level you look at things. So, for example, if you say you get an increase of one, you can look at it at 1%, you look at it in dollar terms, for example, or in percentage terms. And so, you know, we do analysis through our OTEM that shows, you have a 1% increase in the price level for consumers. Well, Oregon has about a $200 billion economy. So 1% is $2 billion. So is it $2 billion or is it 1%? Well, I mean, they're the same because it just depends on how if you're looking at absolute numbers or the percentages. So the percentages here, if you keep your rate low, you can have multiple transactions and stay below 1%. So the risk becomes if you have a higher rate, then you do, that will multiply on itself. We would suspect that to happen at different rates in different industries. The more transactions you have, the more a risk it is. Certain service industries, for example, retail sector, those kinds of areas where you don't have further purchases down the line, it's going to pretty much stay there. You're not going to see as much pyramiding. But if it's, you know, in processing, where you do have multiple transactions, then that's where you're likely to have the risk in pyramiding. And our model produces estimates of how much pyramiding you get in kind of an indirect way by industry sector from a general gross receipts tax.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Always interesting information here in the Revenue Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the corporate tax rate is placed on those C corporations, and the business privilege tax would be impact the the C corporations, the S corporations, the LLCs, the sole proprietorships. So two questions out of that. Number one is, do we have an idea of how the privilege tax impacts those individual sectors?
Representative Marsh, Mr. Chair, we've talked some about that. We know we suspected you'll ask that question. Mm-hmm. We have good data on corporations, on their sales. And, of course, that's how we used the data to come up with our estimates for Measure 97, because we had Chris look through all the detailed corporate returns. We had gross receipts for all the C-Corps. We don't have as good a data from these smaller entities, particularly the proprietors. So we will infer some estimates on that, because we know that's obviously an important issue. So we will get some estimates for you on how that breaks out.
Okay.
But predominantly, you're still going to have, and just based on the data we looked at for Measure 97, remember how concentrated it was. You had just a relatively small group of C-Corps that were paying the vast bulk of it. True, it was over $25 million, but still the numbers were huge. We're going to see a large amount of these collections from the privilege tax will still come from the C corps.
Yeah,
but we'll get you some estimates as what those percentages
and then
look like.
As a
please go ahead. Yeah,
which begs the second question, which is that sooner or later we need to be able to estimate some associated impact with those non C corp filings.
Yes.
Because we talked yesterday, hearkening back to the questions that were raised in terms of what you back out of those other tax returns so that we know kind of where we wind up.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, that one of the things that we have down as a policy issue is how you're going to treat those non-C-Corps that are paying through the personal income tax.
Right.
Now, there's a number of ways you can do that, and that will be an important policy decision if you go in that direction. So particularly if you end up eliminating the corporate income tax.
Right.
And then substituting this broad entity tax, you can look at options as to how you would want to address those that are paying through the personal income tax.
Right. And the alternative, of course, is you could keep both and not have to make an adjustment on the personal side, because it would be equivalent.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Nose, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it'll be interesting to see when we look at what Washington does, because they have, my understanding is they have different rates for different sectors, and so that'll probably reveal something to us about mm-hmm. what's going on there. And then I sort of believe kind of what we, if we're going to go down this road, down a certain road, we should sort of debate on a mechanism, try to settle on a number, maybe Ways and Means informs that for us, maybe we don't care what they think, but and then I think we start to hear from people who want a legitimate exception, and then we figure out what that does to our overall number, and then we start working. That's sort of how I see this works. And I'm guessing Washington will reveal where the likely legitimate exceptions might show up, so I can anticipate them, and then we'll see what else we get.
Mr. Chair, responding to Representative Nose about Washington, there was quite a bit of research that went into Washington's original B&O rates going back to the 80s. I think there's been some deterioration of how the changes are linked now to that original research, but we can look back on both and see, mm-hmm. and that'll give you an idea. And the other thing we'll on my list is the Nevada rates, because those are relatively recent. Okay. In fact, the last year. So see how they tiered their gross receipts rates and give you an idea of what their thinking was anyway.
Mm-hmm. And the alternative way of doing it, which is what we did with the bills that became Measures 66 and 67, is that we waited for people to come in and complain. And they did, and we made some changes in the next session to reflect the fact that we double taxed some people without realizing we'd done it. Yeah, Representative Johnson, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've got to say that Representative Nose and I are remarkably aligned almost on our thought pattern here.
Let's hope that bodes well for other things.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But I guess the question is, maybe you've already worked on this, but we are going to be able to see how the Washington B&O system would have worked, applied to Oregon's economy, and we'll be able to make that comparison as well, because that's a lot of work, obviously. It's much more than just a CAT across the board at point mm-hmm. whatever percent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, you're right. It is in terms of the sectors. Mm-hmm. We have looked at, you know, at a very macro level, how much a Washington B&O would raise in Oregon. But what I did was just assume the average rate that the mm-hmm. B&O implies. So I've taken the B&O collections as a percentage of the Washington economy, and then I can translate that into Oregon. So you can see at the average B&O rate how much you could raise in Oregon. But we haven't gone through and done those individual rates on the individual sectors.
Okay. But that assumes the same mix of different industries or businesses that pay different rates, so that we would end up with the same average.
That's correct, Mr.
Chair. Of course,
that
may not be true. We don't make airplanes here.
That's correct. Oh, we do have a Boeing facility.
Oh, we do? I guess that's true.
Typically what we do is we'll do what we call a top-down estimate, which is kind of has that flawed assumption, but it is kind of a simplification. And then we'll try to do the bottom-up estimate by our sectors. We have an 80-sector general equilibrium model, so we can model at the sectoral level. And we also do have one thing nice about Washington is that with the sales tax, we have really detailed data, and the B&O tax. Mm-hmm. They have good data, you know, B&O tax by industry and what's actually collected.
And you'll have all of that for us.
And they also have a good tax expenditure report.
Good. You'll have all of that for us by 8 o'clock Monday morning.
Right.
Well, we can postpone your tutorial.
Yeah. You can see why our economists often look tired. Because they work through the weekends when they have to. Anything else for this piece? Paul, should we actually carry this over and in case people have additional questions on Monday?
That's fine with me, Mr. Chair. You're posted for Monday for the CPAs.
Yes.
And also for your reconnect bill.
Right.
So we could certainly.
Well, I think just as a matter of caution, I'm going to ask that we carry this over until Monday with the idea in mind that if there are additional questions, or you have additional, or you have a response to some of the questions you've got today. See, I figured out a way to make him work the weekend. We'll have it available on our agenda for Monday.
Okay.
Is that all right?
That's fine.
Okay, let's do that. And okay, you didn't get 35 minutes. You only got four. With that, the committee is adjourned.